News, I'm Steve Norman. President Trump is now saying no to an offer from Russian President Vladimir Putin. AP's Ed Donahue explains.
The president talked about it at the Helsinki summit.
What he did is an incredible offer.
The White House says President Trump disagrees with the Putin offer. It would have allowed the U.S. to question 12 Russians accused of interfering in the 2016 election in exchange for allowing Russia to interview Americans facing accusations by the Kremlin. That includes the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul. There was opposition from both parties to the offer, including Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden.
Strikes me as almost providing aid and comfort to the enemy.
Meantime, President Trump wants another meeting with Putin, and the White House says there is an invitation for the Russian president to come to Washington in the fall. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Meantime, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tells VOA the Trump administration has no intention of allowing Russia to question Michael McFaul, Washington's former ambassador to Moscow and a fierce critic of President Putin.
There were suggestions, comments, thoughts by President Putin with respect to that inquiry. President Trump was very clear. We're not going to force Americans to go to Russia to be interrogated.
The Russian leader proposed letting U.S. investigators interview 12 military intelligence officials indicted in connection with the Russian interference in the 26 U.S. election in exchange for Russian interviews of McFaul. The commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East is saying that he has not received any new guidance from the U.S. military officials on military cooperation with Russia in Syria. United States is currently fighting remnants of Islamic State fighters in Syria, while Russian forces are attacking anti-Assad groups in the country. This is VOA News. Israel has passed legislation that has been welcomed by Jewish nationalists but condemned by Arab citizens. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
The Knesset, Israel's parliament, approved a new law that defines the country as the nation-state of the Jewish people. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it is a historic moment in the history of Zionism and the state of Israel. Netanyahu said minorities have full rights in Israel, but he noted that the majority also has rights. He said the law ensures the Jewish majority for generations to come. But critics say the bill does enormous damage to the state of Israel, whose image abroad is already battered due to its alleged mistreatment of the Palestinians. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Nicaragua has marked the 39th anniversary of the Sandinista Revolution, but many Nicaraguans were not in a celebratory mood. A popular uprising against President Daniel Ortega has left at least 280 people dead, including many students. Ortega's one-time leftist revolutionary who helped topple the U.S.-backed dictator Anastasio Somoza in 1979. Anti-government protesters say Ortega himself has turned into a dictator using what they called fire and bloodshed. Russia and China have requested more time to consider a U.S. request to stop deliveries of refined oil products to North Korea. U.S. asked a United Nations Sanctions Committee last week to halt the shipments after accusing North Korea of exceeding a $500,000 barrel annual limit on fuel deliveries through illegal imports. The quota was among the sanctions imposed by the Security Council last December in response to North Korea's launch of a missile North Korea said is capable of striking anywhere on the U.S. mainland. Automakers, dealers, and suppliers are united in opposition to President Trump's proposed tariffs on imported cars, as well as trucks and auto parts. Opponents who work in the industry joined a bipartisan group of lawmakers outside the U.S. Capitol to voice their concerns. Jennifer Adair is with the auto manufacturer Toyota.
A 25% tariff on imported autos and auto parts would only lead to fewer sales, which leads to fewer American jobs. We cannot let that happen.
Imposing a 25% tariff on imported autos would raise the average price of a new car in the United States by as much as $4,400. Get more news at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman, VOA News.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Friday, July the 20th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The government of Niger warns that different militant groups operating along the country's borders are threatening the security of the state and the region. The country's defense minister is calling for preemptive measures by regional powers against Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups. And the South Sudanese Council of Churches and African Council of Churches are calling upon the East African countries to help bring peace in South Sudan.
As a church, we started to engage them. The obstacle is not from outside. The obstacle is just from within themselves. And the degree at which this conflict has also become so tribal in nature and therefore making it very difficult.
Bishop Akanjero Lemi from South Sudan. And despite an uproar against the new social media tax in Uganda, the Ugandan government says that it will keep taxing users of social media to access online services such as Facebook, Google, WhatsApp, and Skype.
Now, it is evident that government is only trying to buy time so that Ugandans become complacent and used to this oppression, which we refuse. This time, as leaders, we are only coming to join the Ugandans because the people raised their voice, which has been and still stands that this tax must go.
Ugandan Member of Parliament Robert Chagulanyi, who is one of the legislators demanding that the social media tax be scrapped. And the President of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Joseph Kabila, announced that there will be presidential elections in his country on 23rd of December of this year. However, Mr. Kabila did not expressly indicate what his plans were for the highly anticipated elections. Stay tuned. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And we start in Niger, where the government says that different militant groups operating along the country's borders are threatening the security of the state and the region. Niger Minister of Defense Kala Montari told VOA that the militant groups associated with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda pose a serious threat to Niger and could infiltrate the country if preemptive measures are not taken against them by regional powers. Mr. Montari added that the threat of militants could also threaten the security of Europe if they manage to establish safe havens in his country. The Ugandan government says that it will keep a social media tax in place despite an uproar from Ugandan users. Lawmakers began a process Thursday to amend the law that introduced the tax, but only to reduce a separate tax on mobile money services. From Kampala, Uganda, Halima Athumani reports.
Users of social media in Uganda will continue paying tax to access online services such as Facebook, Google, WhatsApp, and Skype. After protests in Kampala last week, social media users were hopeful that the government would scrap the daily tax of 53 cents. On Wednesday, President Yoweri Museveni summoned legislators of the ruling National Resistance Movement Party to discuss the tax. Thursday, Finance Minister Matia Kasaija introduced an amendment to the law, but only to reduce a tax on mobile money services by 0.5%. The social media tax, he said, will remain.
Then on the social media, where we say you pay 200 shillings per day per user and make a contribution.
The social media tax went into effect on July 1st. President Yoweri Museveni said the tax was aimed at curbing gossip online, but users of social media and other online services have described it as unnecessary and an infringement on the right to freedom of expression and freedom to access information. Legislator Robert Chagulanyi, commonly known as Bobby Wine, is facing charges of inciting the public for leading a protest against the tax. He says young Ugandans will not be placated by a reduction in the mobile money tax.
Now, it is evident that government is only trying to buy time so that Ugandans become complacent and used to this oppression, which we refuse. This time, as leaders, we are only coming to join the Ugandans because the people raised their voice, which has been and still stands that this tax must go.
The finance ministry says it has collected about $1.8 million from the social media and mobile money taxes. Many Ugandans are attempting to avoid the taxes by staying offline or using virtual private networks. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
And still in Uganda, Uganda is often praised for its progressive refugee policies. The country hosts around 2 million refugees in 14 camps. And now, civil society activists in Uganda say that the government needs to set aside a development-based fund to help the refugees be more self-reliant as they integrate in society. Reporter Mugume Davis Rakarinji files from Kampala, Uganda.
Richard Sechidianga, the executive director of Uganda National NGO Forum, a coalition of indigenous NGOs in the country, says that although Uganda has good refugee policies, there are not enough funds to facilitate those working with refugees.
Refugees that have come into this country, many of them are not going back soon because the wars are still on. We don't know where the peace deal will end in Sudan. We don't know what is happening with the DRC, you know, all those things. So Burundi is an issue. So we as Uganda must be able to respond to all these issues.
Uganda has been praised by the UN as one of the countries that have the best refugee policies in the world. Michael Osinde, the spokesperson for Uganda People's Congress, or UPC, one of the oldest parties in Uganda, agrees. He says Uganda's pride in helping refugees must be backed by resources to cater for them.
We appreciate this policy and the good heart for Ugandans to extend their hands to welcome refugees. But it goes with the cost, because we know at the end of the day, even for these refugees to settle somewhere where they can have their shelter or structures raised. One, the government of Uganda gives in land. Two, these people use our natural resources. Trees are being cut to raise structures that we term them as shelters to cater for these refugees. Whether we like it or not, there is a cost exchanging a hand.
Sewechidianga says his organization is helping to train members of various local NGOs to handle refugees and refugee resources. Above all, Sewechidianga says those handling refugees' money should be transparent.
What we emphasize from our side is that sometimes what you see as untransparent or weak systems among our organizations are systems that were built to handle smaller projects or smaller amounts of resources. If you have a small organization that has been using, say, 2 million shillings or 20 million shillings, when you give it 200 million to respond, the issue will be that the organization will not have all the capacity and the systems already done.
Uganda is currently a host to over 2 million refugees and asylum seekers, according to UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. The majority of refugees are from South Sudan, many of who fled the fighting in 2013. Others are from DR Congo, Somalia, Sudan, Rwanda, Kenya, and Eritrea. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
This week, Ethiopia's main airline resumed commercial flights to neighboring Eritrea, the latest sign of normalized ties between the longtime foes. The flights mark the latest chapter of good relations that began when Ethiopia's new reformist Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced in June that Addis Ababa would finally honor a deal signed in 2000 to end a two-year border war that killed an estimated 70,000 people. And earlier this month, Ahmed and Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki signed a historic peace agreement that formally ended one of Africa's longest conflicts. And for many watching this historical moment in the Horn of Africa, they question how we got here in the first place. Negusi Mengesha is a veteran journalist who has covered that region for over three decades. He is currently Voice of America's Director of the Africa Service, and he joins me in studio to provide us with a historical perspective of some of the changes we see in that region, especially between these two neighbors.
Until 1996, 1997, 1998, I myself actually went to 1996 to Asmara, reported, really everything looked very peaceful.
These two countries were
Very friendly, they coexisted, they supported each other, every internationally. Yeah. In fact, the APRDF officials, some of them, to be honest, even lobbied the United Nations Here in New York, so that Eritrea becomes independent, actually.
Right.
It's a unique case.
There was a good
very
will,
unique, good relation, yeah. So, but I don't think they have also looked further and understood what is to follow, because this is a country that has lost totally its access to the sea over close now
400. You're talking about Ethiopia at this
Ethiopia,
point. Right.
You know, losing Gaza and Massawa, of course. And also, Eritrea, of course, controls both ports. But same time also, I don't think there was a clear demarcation of the borderline. And geographers, historians, experts would have been invited. And actually, they should have had that solution already on that borderline.
They should have had professionals come in when those countries decided to separate, to demarcate the borders and say, this is where Eritrea starts, this is where Ethiopia.
That was not done, actually.
That was not done.
The conflict. And as you know, also, I mean, African borders are like that. Take Somalia, for instance. The Somalis are in Somalia mainland. Nowadays, even it's, you know, there's the Puntland, the Somaliland, the mainland, the Somali federal government in Mogadishu. But also, there are Somalis in Ethiopia.
Right. So,
in the eastern
all over
part
Africa,
of it.
Basically.
There
Africa
are in the northern district of Kenya, there are Somalis. So, there is a flow of people, actually. Some of them have a grazing conflict also. You know, sometimes they cross the border, go to the other side for grazing. Sometimes they come to the other side also. So the same kind of relation existed also between Eritrea and Ethiopia. So 1998, actually, it was really a surprise when that war broke. And through that war,
did you see it as a person who was covering the conflict? Did you hear any talk?
You could say, well, you could
sense tensions.
Yes. I mean, mind you, there are people also who supported Eritrean independence. Of course, those who struggled for Eritrean independence, of course, they supported it and they made their sacrifice also. There are some Ethiopians also who really said it is their right to declare independence. They're active, you know, the left within the Ethiopian student movement and the political elite also, the left actually supported, gave them sort of, you know, at least the right for self-determination, okay? And this can be decided later through referendum. So there was that kind of understanding. There are also quite a number of Ethiopians, maybe majority, who oppose the Eritrean independence. And who wants balkanization? Who wants separation of Georgia? So there was people who really didn't like that. So, but
that aside, now
that aside, but
right?
Now be realistic. Now, actually, so the war broke. Actually, really, when the war broke, also yes, do you know that's coming? Yes, it's coming.
Was there a war of words between those two countries before it broke?
Yes, for a certain period of time, there was some misunderstanding also, but that it would be blown out of proportion to such level, to be honest, I was surprised.
To the point where a war breaks out,
and close to 100,000 people died from both sides. Close half a million people have been displaced. Really, it was one of the ugliest and bitter war. So later, of course, I mean, there was negotiation. A number of negotiations took place in a number of places. And finally, the President Isaias and the late Prime Minister Melas Zenawi actually signed the Algiers Accord.
Let's jump 20 years later on. Obviously, there had been bad blood between those two countries up until, about 2 months, 3 months ago?
Under a new prime minister.
He decided, okay, we're going to respect this. How historical was that moment in terms of the relationship between these two countries?
He said so many things, to be honest. To be honest, there was this protest that has taken place in Ethiopia, particularly in Oromia region, and followed in the Amhara region. So you could see that there was a need for change,
right.
Actually. People were aspiring for that. They were questioning the question of democratic rights, the question of stopping human rights violations, the question of corruption. And he started taking bold moves. So many moves. He actually said political prisoners should be free. So many political prisoners have been released. There was state emergency declared by the former leader. But that was, I mean, actually, he said, this should be suspended. We don't need a state of emergency. And the most surprising move was, he said, well, we'll respect the Algeria agreement now. I'm ready now to peacefully resolve the conflict with Eritrea. It's a bold move.
So he made a lot of bold moves internally, and then he made that move to honor the Algiers. Were you surprised? Now, obviously, you said, like everybody who has been following this conflict, there's been a lot of turmoil in the country, the protests, the state of emergency.
Be honest, I was so surprised when he took that move. I also said personally, that's my personal view, I said, this is too fast.
Too fast.
But he took it. And the delegation came from Asmara in Addis. He went, headed by the foreign minister of Eritrea. He went to the airport to welcome them himself. And they were hosted like really big celebrities, and they had a good time. They went back, and he promised he will go back.
That was Negusi Mengesha, a veteran reporter from the Horn of Africa. He's also the director of VOA's Africa Service. He was speaking to me at our VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. The South Sudanese Council of Churches and African Council of Churches are calling upon the East African countries to help bring peace in South Sudan. The church leaders held a meeting in Nairobi, Kenya, where Maureen Aljambo reports.
Speaking in Nairobi, the church leaders said that the loss of lives, displacement of people is the cause of unstable regime in South Sudan. Presiding Bishop South Sudan Arkangel Olemi says the prolonged war in South Sudan was made from within and peace can be achieved if other African countries will play part in bringing peace in their nation. He says tribal difference between President Salva Kiir of South Sudan and his opposition counterpart Riek Machar is the main cause of political instability in South Sudan.
This war has of course gone for long, and I think there is a deep-seated anger in the hearts of these politicians, and therefore this actually forms probably the biggest obstacle. And as a church, we started to engage them. The obstacle is not from outside. The obstacle is just from within themselves. And the degree at which this conflict has also become so tribal in nature, and therefore making it very difficult.
On the other hand, the Archbishop, the Diocesan Bishop of Juba, Justin Badi Arama, says it's high time President Kiir and Mr. Machar embrace peace for the sake of its people. Arama's sentiments were also echoed by the South Sudanese Council of Churches chairman Peter Guy Lual, who said both parties must engage for peace to prevail.
We as shepherds of our people in South Sudan, we continue to mourn, to grieve for our country. Our hearts are in pain as we see the suffering of our people, the hungry flocks, and for our leaders with all their fears, their anger, trauma, as they struggle for peace and stability for the people of South Sudan.
So after we attain our independence, we thought that there is no reason again for the people to sacrifice their lives to die in vain. Our aim is that let the war stop, let the gun be silent, and let people come to the table.
In the recent past, the two leaders, President Kiir and Mr. Machar, have been holding peaceful talks in Eastern African countries as they are set to visit Kenya for the same. The church leaders are very optimistic that their talks in Kenya might turn around tables and peace will prevail in South Sudan. Reverend Canon Kais of Uganda is the General Secretary Council of the Anglican Provinces in Africa, while Arkangel Olemi is the presiding bishop African Inland Church in South Sudan.
Our appeal to those who, the well-wishers, the people participating and guiding the negotiations, is that they will refrain, they will be protected against, you know, self-interest.
But I know they will be coming to Kenya, and I'll cry to the president of Kenya, His Excellency Uhuru Muigai Kenyatta, that he should really do everything that is within his means as a leader.
2 years after gaining independence, President Salva Kiir and his Vice President Riek Machar split because of political differences in leadership. An overwhelming majority of South Sudanese voted in a January 2011 referendum to disaffiliate and become Africa's first new country. But today, South Sudan is bleeding, thousands killed, millions displaced, as its people seek refuge in neighboring countries. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Human rights activists say that Australia continues to violate the rights of asylum seekers. The accusation comes as Australia observes the fifth anniversary of the reintroduction of a controversial policy of detaining migrants in remote camps in the South Pacific. And from Sydney, Phil Massa reports that the government in Canberra insists that the measures save lives and boost border security.
Australia set up migrant camps in the South Pacific in 2001 to deter asylum seekers arriving by boat. After a Norwegian freighter, the MV Tampa picked up more than 400 Afghans in waters north of Australia. The offshore centres were closed in 2008 by the former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, but reopened a few years later in response to a steady flow of migrants trying to reach Australia by sea. On July 19, 2013, Prime Minister Rudd said any asylum seeker who arrived by boat would have no chance of being settled in Australia as refugees. Soon afterwards, Canberra signed agreements to again detain migrants on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and the tiny Republic of Nauru. The centre in Papua New Guinea closed last October after a court there said it was illegal. Some former detainees have been resettled in the United States, but hundreds of others who remain in community accommodation on Manus Island say they've been abandoned by Australia and have nowhere to go. They include migrants from Myanmar, Afghanistan, Iran and Pakistan. Some say they've been beaten and robbed by locals and have described their treatment as tortuous. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And now for our sports update with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson. We'll begin with sports with the CAF Champions League, where the winner of this year's CAF Champions League will be given direct entry into the group phase of the next edition of the competition and agreed by the Confederation of African Football, CAF, to alleviate fixture congestion. CAF General Secretary Amir Fahmy says this decision is a one-off and applies only to the 2018 Champions League because of changes to the timing of the annual continental club competition. FIFA has fined Egypt's Football Federation 50,000 Swiss francs for playing a World Cup warm-up game during the prohibited period. No international friendlies were allowed from the 21st to 27th of May, which was a mandatory rest week for World Club players. FIFA says the mandatory rest week was in order to protect players from the final competition. On the 25th of May, Egypt played Kuwait and drew 1-1 in Kuwait City. FIFA has also sanctioned Zamalek Club of Egypt 35,000 Swiss francs and has given the club 60 days to pay late dues to former players, according to a statement posted on the World Football Governing Body's website. The statement added that the club will face an automatic deduction of 6 points and the automatic imposition of a transfer ban for 2 entire and consecutive registration periods if it fails to meet the final deadline. The Gambia Football Federation has appointed the nomadic Tom Senfield as the senior national team coach on a 9-month contract. Formerly with Namibia, Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, Malawi and Togo, the Gambia job is Senfield's 6th coaching commitment with an African team inside 10 years. Manchester City's club record signing Riyad Mahrez will soon be coached by a former City defender with Djemal Belmadi on the brink of being named Algeria coach. Belmadi had a successful trial at Main Road in January 2003 after falling out of favour at Marseille and was fined on loan by Kevin Keegan, going to make 8 appearances, 2 of them starts. Olympic medalist Caster Semenya will be eager to stamp her authority even after further on the 800 metres women event, while sprinters Luxulu Adams and Karina Horn would take on some of the fastest athletes on the international circuit when they compete at the 10th leg of the IAAF Diamond League Series in Monaco later this evening. Fresh from the spectacular showing of 1 minute 54.25 seconds national records in Paris last month, World Champion Semenya faces a typically strong field which includes informed rivals Francis Nisoba of Burundi. And that'll be all for sports. It's back to you, Jackson. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, July 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us and this week with us. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Cloti and Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm Jackson Mvunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend, Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, a look back at the 2018 FIFA World Cup, Les Bleus, Croatia, and other highlights and surprises, as well as the politics, with Sunny Young, host of VOA's Sunny Side of Sports, and João Santarita of VOA's Portuguese to Africa service. The World Cup in Review, that's Press Conference USA, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.